Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From today's Arizona Republic, Brilliant Hacks to Kickstart Your Vegetable Garden by Mary Hunt. As you might imagine, I grew up with more than a few adults greeting me with, "Mary, Mary, quite contrary, how does your garden grow?" Followed by a big smile, or more often, laughter. It was embarrassing, but probably not for the reason you assume. I didn't know how to answer that question. I didn't know what contrary meant. I didn't have a garden, and I worried I was supposed to. I did know to respect adults and speak politely when spoken to, but no one ever told me the right answer to the question I heard over and over again. Today, I have good news and the best response. My seeds have germinated, sprouts are growing to seedlings, outdoor hardening has begun, and I anticipate full planting within weeks. Things are looking good for a successful harvest starting midsummer. Growing a garden that pumps out tasty vegetables doesn't have to cost a fortune. There are many simple ways to have a lush, bountiful garden without emptying your wallet. Whether it's recycling stuff, mixing up your own soil boosters, or scoring cheap seeds and starter plants, I've got you covered with a few of my best gardening hacks, tips, and tricks to save cash while honing your gardening skills. First, borrow and share tools. If you're new to gardening, rather than pouring money into a bunch of gardening tools you're not sure you'll ever use again, let friends and neighbors know what you're up to. Chances are good they'll have items you can borrow. And don't be surprised if you receive a few gifts of tools others want to get rid of. It's worth a shot and will keep your costs down to the bare minimum as you set out to see if gardening is an activity you enjoy and find success in. With some experience under your belt, you'll be better positioned to decide the tools you need to own. And when that time comes, shop garage sales, thrift stores, and Facebook Marketplace. Next, forget seedlings. It's tempting. Those pony packs and endless trays of seedling starts in the garden center are all planted, sprouted, thriving, adorable, and ready to hit the ground. You could have your garden planted before dinner, and you'll pay dearly if you choose to go that route. They're not cheap. What's better? Do it yourself. Seed starting. It's easy to grow your own starter seedlings. Walk away from the pony packs and head to the rack of seed packets. Look at all the choices. You'll have to wait a bit to get your garden thriving, but I can tell you that nurturing plants from germination to maturity is such a rewarding experience. It allows you to witness the entire growth process firsthand. Make sure you read the necessary information on the back of the seed packets. Don't know your zone? Check this color-coded plant hardiness zone map of the United States at www.brex.com/zone_finder to find which hardiness zone you live in. At that site, you'll be able to type in your zip code to find your exact zone. You will need some seed-starting soil, but that's all. Don't buy starting kits or special containers. Get creative with what you have at home. Egg cartons, toilet paper rolls, yogurt cups, paper coffee cups, and fast food containers can be repurposed into seed-starting containers. Just be sure to poke drainage holes in the bottom, then fill the containers with the soil. Greenhouse from the salad bar. The next time you enjoy a salad bar lunch, don't toss out the plastic clamshell container. Instead, give it a second life as a mini greenhouse for spring seed starting. After cleaning the container, add airflow by punching small holes in the top with the tip of scissors, a knife, or an awl and hammer. Fill the bottom half with potting mix or your preferred seed starting soil, then plant your seeds according to seed packet instructions. Water lightly, close the lid, and place in a sunny spot. Watch as your seeds sprout in this cool little greenhouse, which traps warmth and moisture while letting in sunlight. Moving seedlings outdoors. After the last frost in your area, garden.org/apps/frost-dates, and 2 weeks before outdoor planting, gradually introduce your seedlings to weather conditions in their future garden home. Begin by placing them outside for a few hours in the afternoon shade, shielded from wind. Return them indoors before nighttime temperatures decrease. Each day, extend their outdoor visit gradually and expose them to increasing amounts of direct sunlight. By the end of the 2 weeks, unless freezing temperatures are expected, the seedlings can remain outdoors in a sunny location until you're prepared to transplant them into the garden. Known as hardening, this process removes the shock of climate change for these baby seedlings by introducing their eventual climate conditions gradually. This gives plants the best chance for maturity and your successful harvest. More gardening hacks. You can find 18 more of my favorite gardening hacks, tips, and tricks at everydaycheapskate.com/garden hacks. Come visit. We can share stories. From the April-May issue of Phoenix Home and Garden magazine, the garden issue, Art from the Garden. The Art and Science of Fabric Dyeing Desert Style by Laurie A. Johnson. The term garden artist evokes a plethora of possibilities, from landscape designer to outdoor sculptor or plein air painter, but one Valley resident takes garden art to a new level by extending the beauty of her outdoor garden into her home via the art of fabric dyeing. Cultivating a garden that is visually beautiful and productive feels to me like an artist painting a canvas, choosing and mixing individual bloom colors, heights, textures, and seasons to create an enticing scene, says Martha, also known as Petal Peeker on social media. Creating art from plants for use inside the home is a way of extending a garden's joy and happiness. Martha first discovered her love for desert gardening a decade ago after purchasing a home with a barren backyard and turning it into a welcoming space for family and friends. "I love everything about cultivating a garden and nurturing plants and the earth," she says, describing her current landscape as a low-water cottage garden filled with native and desert-adapted pollinator plants. She also grows edible flowers to complement her vegetable and fruit gardens, as well as herbs for making teas. But her newest obsession is her dye garden. During the pandemic, Martha found herself home with two young children with only the backyard for entertainment. One day, her young son pulled all the petals off sunflowers she was about to bring indoors. "I remembered reading in a seed catalog about beautiful Hopi black sunflowers that are used by Native American tribes to dye basketry and wool and thought, well, I might as well put these sunflower heads into a pot with water with some fabric and see what happens, since they aren't all that cheerful in a vase without petals," she recalls. "When the material came out a dusky plum, I was hooked on the beautiful magic of creating colors with plants." From that auspicious beginning, Martha continued to experiment with techniques for fabric dyeing. "I think a person could spend a lifetime learning, experimenting, and making with natural dyes and still not do it all," she says. Her favorite techniques include eco-printing, capturing the likeness of a flower onto fabric, and immersion dyeing, soaking fabric in a pot containing water and dye extracted from the hidden colors of a plant. This year, she plans to learn more about a third technique, block printing. Natural fabric dyeing is both an art and a science. Research into centuries of process refinement as well as personal experimentation are keys to identifying plants best suited for the art. The modern dyer can rely on the historical breadth of knowledge available for plants that have shown great color fastness, such as madder, weld, indigo, and cochineal, while also enjoying discovery and experimentation to find what colors are hiding in the native flora around their home, Martha says. While just about all plants can produce color, interestingly, yellow is the most common and easiest to come by. Only a small subset of plants and a few insects contain the compounds that create long-lasting color. In fact, the word tinctoria in a plant's scientific name is an indicator that it is a reliable dye source, she adds. In addition to experimenting with different plants, Martha also tests different substrates. The color that a plant imparts on fabric depends on many factors, from the type of fabric to how the fabric is pre-treated for dyeing to the season a plant is harvested. "If I put wool, silk, cotton, and linen into the same pot of dye, they will all come out different shades of the same color," she explains. Sometimes, the color of the plant material will indicate the subsequent dye color, such as a sunshine yellow extracted from marigolds, but at other times, the plant provides no clue as to the dye compounds within. For instance, the green leaves of indigo create a striking blue dye, and the cheerful red skin of pomegranates creates a yellow dye, she says. The color fastness of a particular plant dye depends on a combination of factors, the plant, the fabric, and the pretreatment method used. Martha has found that wool and silk generally bond better with natural dyes than with cotton. She also avoids synthetic fabrics. My approach is that natural dyes are for natural fabrics, and at the end of a fabric's life, it can be returned to the earth and composted instead of contributing to a fabric waste and pollution. I prefer to source my fabric secondhand as much as possible, from old home textiles to thrift stores. As for the fruits for labor, Martha makes a variety of unique apparel and home goods from her dyed fabrics. I find so much joy in bringing the garden inside and decorating my home and special occasions with items from nature, whether it's flower-dyed fabric used as a table runner, plant-dyed ribbons for seasonal wreaths, leaf-printed Christmas stockings, and so on. I also enjoy sewing garments and quilts with my plant-dyed fabrics, and imagine the recipient wrapped in my love and flowers. The artist also occasionally sells her plant-dyed ribbons and fabrics via Instagram. Before dyeing fabrics to be sewn or sold, I thoroughly test the color fastness of my experimental dyes to ensure they are heirloom quality, Martha says. My plant-dyed ribbons are used for bridal and special occasion bouquets and wreaths. Colors from nature go together so well and have a luminous quality in a way that conventionally dyed colors simply lack. Her like-minded buyers certainly agree with that sentiment. Florist Christina Blodgett found that Martha's natural dyed ribbons align perfectly with her mission of sustainable floral design. Whether I'm wrapping a bouquet, crafting a boutonniere, or integrating fabric into an installation, using ribbons or fabric that are unique to Arizona is crucial for delivering a floral service centered around mindfulness, Blodgett says. When Debbie Middleman hosted her first floral design workshop, she wanted to include local growers and artisans and commissioned a set of silk ribbons from Martha for use in bouquets and wearables. They settled on a palette of spring colors made from native chaparral, goldenrod, indigo, and cochineal to dye the silk in shades of dusty pink and mauve, soft gold, and yellow and ethereal blues. The guests were delighted to have these ribbons to use at the workshop and to take them home with them, Middleman says. Garden Solutions. Hello, friends. We're entering the most colorful time of year in the desert garden when bloom seasons overlap as winter and spring flowering plants add vibrant interest to the landscape. This is the time of year when Arizonans are the envy of residents of cold winter climates who flee to the desert to enjoy our warm weather and beautiful outdoors. Spring is the busiest time of year in the garden, especially when it comes to pruning and fertilizing. Often, plants are automatically pruned at this time of year, whether they need it or not. The truth is that we tend to over-maintain many of our shrubs, often to their detriment. Before you trim, check out my guidelines here that will lead to healthier and more attractive shrubs with less work. In our next issue, I will share my best tips for creating a heat-proof garden that thrives through the summer. I welcome your questions, which may be featured on these Garden Solutions pages. Please direct your queries to info@azplantlady.com. Before we know it, the summer heat will be here, so I invite you to take time to enjoy our wonderful weather within your own outdoor space and experience the unique beauty that exists in the desert garden. And that was from Noel, a.k.a. AZ Plant Lady at azplantlady.com. Add summer blooming annuals before it gets hot. One of the best ways to bring bright splashes of color to outdoor spaces is by adding flowering annuals, such as Angelonia and Gomphrena, to containers and other high-profile areas in the garden. However, if you plant them too late in spring, they can have difficulty growing roots and becoming established due to the heat. When first placed in the soil, the priority is to grow roots to enable them to take up water, which is vital to summer survival. This means that you will likely have to pull out your cool season flowering annuals while they're still blooming, which can be hard. However, it is necessary to ensure healthy plants through the summer. So here's a question that was sent in by a reader. To accommodate our patio's new design, our landscape architect has suggested relocating our beloved olive tree to a different spot in our yard. We're worried about replanting and whether it will be successful. And here's the answer. You are right to be concerned. The older and larger a tree is, the more stress it will undergo when transplanted to another area, and there is a chance that it may not be successful. Whenever a plant is relocated, it loses a percentage of its roots, and its ability to take up water is reduced. According to ISA-certified arborist Jason Klug, the key to maximizing the success of moving a tree is to keep its roots intact. The use of a truck with a large hydraulic spade that will scoop up the tree and its roots and move it to a prepared hole is your best method towards success. Due to the variables involved, relocating a tree should be done in consultation with a certified arborist. Here's the next question, was sent in by a reader. I love having aloes in my garden, but over time they multiply, outgrow their space, and form dead sections. At this point, they just aren't attractive anymore. Is there a way to bring them back, or should I just start over? And here's the answer. These succulent plants are native to Africa and the Middle East, yet most aloe species flourish in our desert climate. Many are clumping types that produce new clusters on the outside, causing the original planting to expand its borders. As they grow and mature, older plants can turn brown. In some arrangements, aloes are meant to stand singly to show off their spiky shape. Whether you want a mass planting or a standalone plant, the solution to keeping them looking great is to divide them every 3 to 5 years. To do this, you can dig up the entire clump and break off a smaller section with roots and replant. Discard the rest or give them away. Alternatively, you can use a shovel to divide the aloes in the ground without digging up the entire mass. The best time of year to do this is in late spring, once they have finished flowering. And here's another question sent in by a reader. Last year, our tree had a bumper crop of oranges, but some years, very little fruit is produced. Is there anything I can do to ensure that I will have plenty of citrus on my tree next winter? And here's the answer. It is common to experience a bountiful harvest one year while the subsequent harvest is disappointing. Citrus are alternate bearing, meaning that years when they're heavy with fruit are often followed with one where a lighter yield is produced. Understandably, this can lead to the belief that something is wrong when you experience less fruit production. Environmental factors such as extreme temperatures and water availability can also affect the amount of citrus that forms. Make sure that you are irrigating to a depth of at least 2 feet each time you water. According to the University of Arizona Cooperative Extension, orange and lemon trees should be fed 3 times a year in January, February, March, April, and in May, June using a citrus food fertilizer which aids in maximum production. For those of you living in low to middle elevations, now is the ideal time to cut back shrubs and ground covers. For those that bloom winter into spring, prune them back by up to half size once the flowers have faded. For plants that bloom in spring and summer, pruning is done once the threat of freezing temperatures has passed, which is typically in March and sometimes again in late summer if they're outgrowing their space. Get rid of stinknet, also known as globe chamomile, a highly invasive, highly flammable weed that is rapidly overtaking natural desert areas and home landscapes. This flowering member of the daisy family has become more prevalent in recent years due to our generous winter rains, allowing it to outcompete native desert flora. This unwelcome guest begins to grow in winter and flowers in spring before dying in summer. The foliage is finely textured like a carrot leaf, and the plant produces globe-shaped yellow flowers, which when crushed, release a foul odor. As they dry up in summer, each tiny bloom releases up to 100 seeds, so it's important to remove them before they turn brown. Prune summer flowering shrubs now, if needed, to reduce their size or remove wayward growth. If you intend to do any severe pruning, now is the best time to do it. For shrubs that bloom once a year in winter or spring, such as feathery cassia or little John bottlebrush or valentine bush, wait to cut them back after their flowers have faded. Directly sow warm season vegetable seeds such as bush beans, cantaloupe, cucumber, and okra outside in the garden. Transplants can also be added instead of using seeds. There is no need to dig up the garden ahead of each growing season. Add 2 to 3 inches of compost and lightly mix in bone and blood meal before planting. transition to summer flowering annuals in mid-spring to allow them time to grow roots before the heat and stress of summer arrives. Have fun trying some newer types, such as Angelonia, which has flowering spikes and comes in many different colors, including white peach, red, purple, and pink. In high elevations, prune trees in early spring if needed, removing any dead, diseased, or crossing branches. A dead branch will make a cracking sound when pulled, while a live one will be flexible and have a thin inner green layer under the outer bark. Shrubs that flower in summer and fall, but not in spring, should be cut back before April, including roses. Wait to clean up garden debris until temperatures are over 50 degrees. Pollinators such as bees and butterflies overwinter underneath fallen leaves in the garden. Removing dead flowers, leaves, and stems too early means you'll get fewer pollinators in the summer and fall. Begin broccoli, cauliflower, and tomato seeds indoors for them to be planted outdoors in the summer. Annual flowers such as cosmos, marigolds, and zinnias can also be sowed inside. Use LED lights, which are more reliable than fluorescent lights, to maximize growth. Drive down any neighborhood street and you will inevitably see front yards filled with manicured green blobs, which are the result of excessive pruning that removes the natural shape, flowers, and beauty of shrubs. This style of pruning became popular during the Victorian era in the late 1800s and is still prevalent in the Southwest. It is the default maintenance practice of many landscape professionals and homeowners. However, this trimming method is unhealthy for plants as it constantly strips away the foliage they need to make food and energy for survival. The result is a shrub with a thin outer green layer and a dense interior where sunlight cannot penetrate. Over time, areas will turn brown and die off, shortening the plant's lifespan. Frequent pruning also causes plants to use more water as they struggle to regrow their leaves when compared to a shrub that is pruned twice a year or less. So what can we do to avoid this outdated maintenance practice? First, allow shrubs to grow to their mature size where they will add texture and interest to the landscape. A bonus is that you will get more flowers and a welcome color around your home. But what if you have a landscape filled with formerly shaped shrubs? In most cases, you can revert them to their original form. To do this, severe pruning is needed, which involves cutting back approximately 1 foot from the ground in the spring. In healthy plants, this will stimulate new growth within a few weeks. Older plantings, or those in poor health, may not grow back. In this case, you can replace them with a new one. Pruning shrubs every year is not necessary if there's room for them to grow. To ensure your plants have room to spread out, check out the Arizona Municipal Water Users Association at amwua.org/plants, a good resource for this information. If shrubs are too close together, you may need to remove some or switch them out for smaller ones. Finally, how do you ensure your landscaper does not shear shrubs during each visit? Take them off autopilot and stress that you don't want your plants sheared unless you specifically direct them to do so. Then, instruct them to prune your shrubs when needed in spring and how much to cut off. I encourage you to begin this year with pruning less. You'll have healthier and more attractive plants and save time and money. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know that we feature a story each week from the terrific book called Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called Flowers for a Newborn Child, written by Claire Bainan, and there's a quote here from Bishop Arthur Cleveland. Flowers are words which even a babe may understand. It was a cold, drizzly day. Mist nudged up against the windows and doors of the house. I was adding more wood to the fire when I heard a knock at the front door. Judy was standing on the doorstep, wearing her usual faded green sweatpants, a hand-knitted sweater, and a silver tiara. She only wore her tiara on special occasions. She held a large, crumpled plastic bag in her arms. We smiled warmly at each other. "Flowers for the newborn child," she declared, holding out the bag. I welcomed my friend and accepted the package. There was no sign of any flowers, but I said thank you anyway. Judy has always been full of surprises. If she said she brought flowers, then sooner or later flowers would appear. I've never known anyone even vaguely like her. She's always approached things differently, danced to her own tune. At 76 years of age, she still considered such practical things as umbrellas or raincoats unnecessary on rainy days. She would simply stride out in any weather, defying rain or snow. "I've yet to hear of a person dissolving because of a little extra moisture in the air," she'd say. That particular morning, there were tiny jewels of rain nestled in the weave of her sweater, a cascade of droplets adding sparkle to her wiry gray hair, rain still clinging to the tip of her nose. She shook her head vigorously back and forth like a dog after a swim, then matter-of-factly straightened her tiara. "Where is the little darling?" she asked. "I'm dying to meet her, dear." I led the way to the sky-blue door at the end of the narrow hall. We both looked in, barely breathing. The curtains in the little room were open. The low square windows framed a dripping wisteria vine in full flower. My daughter lay fast asleep in her grandfather's wicker baby basket. She was loosely swaddled in a cotton blanket. From the walls around her, pale pink and blue sheep grazed peacefully in her newborn baby landscape. I looked at Judy. She was gazing intently at my child. At first she said nothing. Then she whispered, "Alessandre, Alessandre." She leaned over the wicker basket, ran her knotted brown hand lightly across Alessandre's pale sleeping cheek. Judy's bright eyes shone at the sight of a smudge of black hair splayed out on the white sheet like a charcoal drawing. "I brought flowers for you, Alessandre," Judy said. She glanced briefly in my direction before she continued. "Your mother has them, dear, in that plastic bag she's holding, but these flowers are the kind that will last forever." I opened the bag and peered into it. I looked up, confused. Judy straightened herself and began to explain. "I've made her a blanket, dear. I used the wool from my sheep. I searched until I found a variety of plants and organic materials to create the brightest pigment dyes. Then I matched the first letters of the natural colors with the letters in Alessandre's name." She took the bag from me, unfolded the blanket, and scattered a summer garden into the room. I caught my breath. Alessandre stirred in her sleep. I stood entranced as I listened to Judy name the colors she had knitted into this exuberant striped blanket, a work of art that both described and spelled my first child's name. Aloe, lichen, iris, sage, alum, ultramarine, nasturtium, dandelion, red iron oxide, and English marigold. Alessandre. Judy spread her worn hand over the rainbow. Wool the color of softest sand separated each of the colored rows. "I dyed the wool in my tin tub, then spun it into skeins," she went on. "I used my longest, thickest needles to knit the colors. With time, the weave will stretch and the blanket will grow, just as Alessandre will." Well, that was 14 years ago. The same small blanket that fit the wicker basket grew with the baby to fit the crib, comforted my toddler in her daybed, and followed my girl to her full-size bed. Every night, Judy's flowers snuggle close to the lovely, long-limbed young woman who is my daughter, Alessandre. That's called Flowers for a Newborn Child, written by Claire Bainan, one of the many stories that make up Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And that's a Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.